Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Women's Studies Program and the Humanities Foundation. Speaking will be Associate Professor Hilary Neroni, Director of the Film and Television Studies Program at the University of Vermont. Her lecture is titled, Terror, Torture, and Feminine Masquerade, The Case of Alias versus 24. We begin with an introduction by Professor Barbara Gottfried from the Women's Studies Program.
On behalf of the Women's Studies Program and the Humanities Foundation at Boston University, it is my pleasure to welcome you to today's lecture, Terror, Torture, and Feminine Masquerade, The Case of Alias versus 24. Our guest lecturer, Hilary Neroni, is Associate Professor and Director of the Film and Television Studies Program at the University of Vermont. Her areas of interest include representations of gender and race in contemporary American film, violence in film, women directors, feminist theory, psychoanalysis, and Marxism. I first encountered Professor Neroni's work while teaching women in film. Her essay on Jane Campion's film Holy Smoke, starring Kate Winslet and Harvey Keitel, really pulled the course together in its exploration of the French feminist conceptualization of jouissance, both as pleasure and self-possession that powerfully disrupts gender expectations. Her book, The Violent Woman, Femininity, Narrative, and Violence in Contemporary American Cinema, unpacks the cultural anxieties expressed in and by films about violent women. As she explains in the preface to the book, people tend to ignore the complex way in which violence exists in society at every level, but especially the way in which violence is an integral part of changing gender expectations. Violent women today can be found across all genres of film. It is imperative to look at these new violent women and understand both why we are so fascinated, even excited by them, and what they reveal about violence in our society and its cinema. Rather than embodying some mythical pro-homicide movement, violent women actually disrupt the structure of filmic narratives, call into question our conceptions of masculinity and femininity, and reveal the limits of ideological structures, most especially those involving gender, that regulate our experiences. And that's from the preface to Professor Neroni's book. Today, Professor Neroni will extend her insights into film violence to two popular TV shows which feature representations of powerful female figures, Alias and 24. Professor Neroni.
Thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me here. It's a pleasure to come to Boston and to come talk to all of you. I actually got asked by an interviewer once when I was writing that project, so are you pro-homicide? I was like, am I pro-homicide? No, I'm just interested in violence on film and television. So I worked it into the preface because I thought it was such a weird question. But I also thought that it was sort of indicative of the ways in which people are both drawn to violence and they want to see it, but they also feel strange talking about it or analyzing it in any substantive way. And they feel, so they both sort of love it and want to disavow it constantly. So I was interested in focusing on a different kind of engagement with violence, both in that book and then also in this investigation into Alias and 24. Okay, so I'll start with my paper. Both Alias, which was on television from 2001 to 2006, and 24, which was on from 2001 to the present. How many people here are watching 24 currently? Just one? Two, okay. Two. And myself. Operate in the same genre, the spy thriller. And both depict attempts to uncover threats to the United States and the entire world. The major difference between the two series is the status of the lead figure. In Alias, it is Sidney Bristow, played by Jennifer Garner. And in 24, it is Jack Bauer, played by Kiefer Sutherland. In this case, sexual difference corresponds to radically different conceptions of truth within the larger narrative structure. In order to accomplish their various missions and save the country, both Sidney Bristow and Jack Bauer must discover hidden truths. The conception of truth that predominates on 24 is one that predominates today and even informs the war on terror. In this world, we find truth in and through the body. Though it is always hidden as part of some nefarious plot, one can always access it because the body will reveal it under extreme enough coercion. There is a direct through line from the idea of truth that informs 24 to the depictions of torture for which critics have so heartily criticized the show. This conception of truth sees it as the opposite of fiction, as what one arrives at when the fiction is torn away. So, you know, obviously that in the torture chamber, and this is, you know, also held by the Bush administration in terms of the reason, you know, all the debates about waterboarding and everything, but the idea that stripping away the person, stripping something away from them through physical harm will produce truth, right? That's kind of at the core of this idea that truth is located somehow in the body, right? This idea about why torture works. So the fact that 24 involves a masculine protagonist who procures this sort of truth is, according to my reading, not coincidental. Alias, in contrast, with its female hero, rejects this predominant conception of truth. On Alias, truth is not opposed to fiction, but inextricably from it. One arrives at truth not by torturing the suffering body until one has ripped away the lie, but by employing a fiction that will unlock someone's fantasy and thereby allow the truth to come to light. Here, truth is the truth of a subject rather than the truth of a body. As with 24, it is not coincidental that this alternate conception of truth occurs on a show with a female protagonist. The female action hero has a long history, but began to become commonplace in the early 1990s, in films in the early 1990s, before migrating into television in shows such as Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Xena, Princess Warrior, and The X-Files. Sidney Bristow is in some sense the high point of this trajectory because she manages to integrate the violence of the action hero and femininity without sliding either. Though she's a contemporary female hero in her capacity to defend herself and to inflict pain on others, she also almost always accomplishes her missions through the very traditional female strategy of masquerade, whereas Jack Bauer turns to torture when he must find out the truth. Sidney Bristow turns to masquerade, or more specifically, to her aliases. That's the title of the show. How many people here watch Alias or have watched it? Okay, more. That's good. every few episodes, we see her perform a different alias. For example, she's taken on the role of punk girl, Southern belle, prostitute, wealthy art collector, hit woman, right? She's a different character each time. In order to acquire information, gain access to an otherwise restricted space, gain the trust of an individual important to her goals and other objectives, all of which help her accomplish her mission. The alias is a fiction that allows Sidney to discover a hidden truth, and it almost always succeeds because it plays into the fantasy of the character that the alias attempts to deceive. When would-be terrorists see the alias, they see their own fantasy rather than Sidney Bristow, and this permits Sidney to discover what they are planning, the truth of their desire. The series stresses the contrast between Sidney at home, at work, and when she assumes an alias during a mission. When she's not in the field, her clothes and overall aesthetic is plain and even minimalist. The series shows Sidney consistently serious in her approach to her work and her home life. Her aliases, on the other hand, range from more realist feminine depictions that are still quite different from her own, to truly spectacular and completely adorned feminine characters. For example, when her aliases require her to appear in dance clubs or trendy bars, She often wears a wig from red to blue or platinum, with outrageously high heels or knee-length boots and miniskirts, complete with all the jewelry and makeup one would imagine. The plethora of aliases that she performs throughout the series presents a wide spectrum of the types of femininity one can see on film and television. The premise of the show is that these performances of femininity succeed because femininity is what society expects of women. Her masquerade provides privileged access to the truth of desire precisely because it involves an understanding of how desire operates. On a theoretical level, however, in my opinion, the key to alias is not what is shown, but instead what is never shown, and that is the preparation for these performances. Not all preparation is hidden. In fact, Sydney and her crew are regularly shown preparing to go out on an assignment, when they research the item or information they're going after, or when they're presented with mini lectures from the experts in their office on the components of their mission. But Alias never shows us Sydney herself constructing her appearance for her elaborate performances of femininity. Instead, the show just cuts a very hard cut. It just cuts right to her entrance into the scene. So over 7 years of a series, they never show her putting her outfits on. They never show her constructing the image that she performs. This is completely incongruous with the majority of traditions within film and television regarding representing the production of femininity, which often emphasize the preparation and the pleasure of that preparation over the performance. For example, in films like Pretty Woman, right, which are all sort of about, reshaping her, watching her go shopping, watching her get dressed, and so forth. La Femme Nikita, if people have seen La Femme Nikita, you know, where there's these lengthy scenes in which she's learning how to put on makeup in the mirror, learning how to walk, learning how to dress, and then Miss Congeniality, if anyone has seen that. And television shows, reality shows, like Extreme Makeover, What Not to Wear, and Miss America Remake, spend much of their time filming the participants trying on the clothes and even shopping for the clothes before they present them as a final product. The outcome of this emphasis is that the woman is finally produced as her true best self, which also happens to usually be upper class, trendy, etc., which is meant to make her a happier person. By including the preparation for the masquerade, these films and television shows actually emphasize the truth of the performance. The performance evolves out of the preparation and thus appears natural, even as we watch its construction. Preparation is paradoxically used to hide the fictional status of the masquerade. None of this is present in Alias. The viewer never sees Sydney's preparation for the performance, and it occurs through a jarring hard cut that confronts the viewer with an often barely recognizable Sydney in the midst of her performance. The hard cut to the performance of the alias that the series utilizes every time emphasizes the performance to the exclusion of all else. So it emphasizes that moment of femininity as fiction, you know, fiction as such, rather than something authentic that she's built into, you know. This is established by the absence of the preparation for the alias and the fact that this absence is in conversation with and in opposition to the tradition of such scenes in the history of film and television. The viewer never sees her picking out her clothes or dressing for either of these performances. Sometimes the show reveals why she needs to create a certain alias. For example, they need her to act like someone who's missing, or a scientist who could get into the facility that they need to access. But other times, the show does not explain the alias, and this adds to an element of detection for the viewer to try to figure out why she is performing this particular alias. The mystery behind the performance adds to its fictionality. And in this way, the series asks the viewer to intellectually contemplate what types of femininity different areas of society expect from women. And while her lines fall into the tradition of pithy lines that action heroes utter during their physical struggles, they also emphasize the working aspect of her aliases. The exclusion of her preparation rips apart the traditional continuous trajectory of signification associated with femininity. No longer grounded in the ideological authenticity and or pleasure in constructing femininity, these aliases bring together seemingly contradictory ideas and traits. The performance of femininity is folded in and considered part of the smartness, agility, toughness, and general exceptionalness of Sidney's talents for espionage. In this environment, performing femininity becomes one intelligent, well-used tool, amongst others, to procure information, save lives, and protect the country. The series separates femininity from any truth value as it highlights the functionality of the performance. By not showing the construction of her aliases, the television series provides a unique depiction of femininity. The effect this has on the representation of femininity is to both decouple it from signifying authenticity and to redefine it as a representation of the impossibility of a stable whole identity, which we often imagine femininity to be. Femininity testifies here to the split in Sidney's subjectivity rather than to its revealed essence. The aliases are part of her work persona. Sidney's unhappy moments or problems have nothing to do with needing a makeover. And thus, on a structural level, the aliases do not serve to make her happier, nor reveal her authentic self. And yet, there is still something in this performance, qua performance, that represents Sidney as subject. Sidney clearly embraces these performances as fiction, and it is her facility with this fiction and the show's belief that it is only within the fiction that truth is engaged, that structures her identity and the show's discourse. Alias holds to psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan's maxim that truth is structured like a fiction. Fiction is the path to truth, and as the series demonstrates, there is no way to separate truth from fiction. Every truth remains tied to its fictional form. And the belief that we can separate truth from fiction causes us to constantly miss truth altogether. Its conception of truth leads Alias away from the body and toward the subject. Despite the sexy outfits that Sidney Bristow wears, she never reveals herself, nor does she try to strip bare her target. Instead, she uses a fiction to discover the truth that would otherwise be inaccessible. The truth of Alias consists in highlighting the success of the fiction, just as the lie of 24 consists in emphasizing the success of torture, which is an insistence of truth dissociated from fiction. One must, I claim, see 24 as a masculinist counterpoint to Alias. Like Sidney Bristow, Jack Bauer is an agent whose actions continually affect national and global political stability. The show revolves around Jack, though its most famous and marketed characteristic is that each season takes place over a period of 24 hours, and each episode depicts 1 hour. The episodes keep the viewer informed of the elapsed time so as to keep us aware of the feeling that we are living this one day with the characters. The chronometrical perspective gives us the sense that we are cued into reality itself, as the term for it, real time, suggests. That is, the most significant aspect of the form of 24 represents an attempt to reject fictionality and assert reality. So even, you know, in the form where you're experiencing it in one day, they're trying to emphasize the idea that this show is reality. We're experiencing, you know, where it just, in, we're, even like the time in the way that it's presented is presented in a real way. Throughout all aspects of the series, 24 relies on what Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben has called a philosophy of bare life, in which life functions as the only value. Whatever Jack does has an implicit moral justification because he is doing it to save lives, even if it costs a few lives in the process. 24 is a symptom of exactly the proliferation of bare life philosophy that Agamben chronicles. His ideas develop out of Foucault's theories of the biopolitical body. Agamben argues, bare life is no longer confined to a particular place or a definite category. It now dwells in the biological body of every living being. Agamben contends in his work that mainstream ideology and its politics is now dominated by a philosophy of bare life, one which values survival above all else, including above things like freedom and equality. Within the philosophy of bare life, life becomes the only value. It is this philosophy, he argues, that has led to modern political atrocities, such as the Holocaust, the Japanese internment camps, and Guantanamo. By suspending the law in the name of survival. So the most famous kind of way of describing this is the ticking bomb scenario, right? So that there's a bomb about to go off somewhere, and we have a terrorist suspect in front of us. And so the logic is, do whatever you have to that suspect, because if you don't, right, the millions of people could die through this bomb, or thousands of people could die, right? So that's kind of like the quintessential example of you're weighing lives, right? But it's always down just to survival. It's all about only survival, not about larger concepts of, say, freedom or equality. Through his scholarship, Agamben wants to, however, transcend the hold that bare life has on the political arena. So through its representation of torture and the character of Jack Bauer, 24 clearly shows the tie between a philosophy of bare life and patriarchal ideology. One of the key aspects of the series is both the amount of physical pain Jack receives throughout each episode and the amount of torture that Jack uses to complete his missions. In 24, the most heroic, and this basically equates with the most masculine individuals, like Jack Bauer, can both withstand torture and procure information through torture. Torture serves as the privileged vehicle for access to truth. When Jack must know a hidden truth that will save the country if revealed, he inevitably resorts to torture. This apotheosis of torture has become especially apparent during this current season of 24, for any of you who are keeping up with it, as the show has attempted to respond to criticism for its depiction of torture. In reaction to this criticism, the makers of the show disbanded the counter-terrorist unit that Jack and his colleagues were working for before this season. That was, and they were the unit responsible for the torture, and began the season with Jack on trial for his misdeeds, most especially his torture. In addition, the show's producers announced that the show would take up a new attitude toward torture in the spirit of the new administration in Washington. The result, however, is astonishing. Rather than show Jack as blameworthy for past torturing, this season exculpates him and stresses that the failure to follow his methods is now leading to successful terrorist attacks. Torture remains as necessary as ever. Jack is working with FBI agents in this season who play by the book, and they constantly come upon situations in which, in the end, they have to play it Jack's way in order to save the country. On 24, truth lies in the tortured body, and Jack must use violence to rip away the fictions that hide it. Fiction is not a path to truth, but an obstacle to it. This is the conception of truth that produces and informs the war on terror. But not only that, it is also the conception of truth that inevitably fails. Though 24 depicts Jack's torturing as always effective, the truth is that torture does not work because it fails to account for the desiring subjectivity that is being tortured. The torture victim is not just a body, but a subject attuned to the desire of the other. While being tortured, the victim attempts to read the torturer's desire and respond to it with the appropriate fiction, not with the truth. Torture is a fiction procurement device, not a privileged mode to access the truth. Alias, however, has a very different approach to the effectiveness of and the representation of torture. The reason for the de-emphasis of torture on this show as compared to 24 has to do with a philosophy toward torture that I would say is developed through its seemingly unlikely comparison to the aliases. The success rate of using aliases in the field for Sydney and her crew is very high. It almost never fails to work all or most of the way. In general on Alias, however, torture in the Jack Bauer tradition does not work. The CIA agents almost never get any information through torture sessions. They try, but it doesn't. It's not as often as on 24, but they do try. It doesn't seem to work. While violence is certainly employed in Alias, it is not the focus of the scene. Instead, the alias is the site at which the action is happening. In other words, it is within the alias that they succeed or fail, not within the torture. The use of an alias functions to procure truth, but it is based on the idea that this truth is the truth of a desire. For Alias, the target is a speaking, fantasizing subject, and one can get at the truth of this subject only through a fiction. 24, on the other hand, approaches the person being tortured as a body instead of as a subject. And the truth of the body can be found directly in and on the body, or so the torturer believes. As a spy thriller series, Alias is similarly caught up with finding truth, but it approaches it in a very different way than 24. This might be best exemplified in Sydney's relationship with her mother, Irina, played by Lena Olin. The family relationships on Alias are very complicated. Irina, we learn, is a Russian spy. And at times in the series, Sydney has to arrest her. Throughout the series, her mother is constantly telling her that the truth takes time. And in one episode called The Truth Takes Time, Irina escapes the CIA prison she's being held in, but leaves behind a pair of diamond earrings that belonged to her grandmother for Sydney to find. When Sydney fiddles with them, a message blinks out of them. The message, truth takes time, is communicated through Morse code, a seemingly contradictory artifact. The earrings fit perfectly within the form of the show. Not just because they recall the earrings from the earlier scene. Passed down through three generations, these earrings are both high-tech and an ancestral heirloom. Common symbols of femininity, these diamond earrings have been refashioned in such a way that only a well-trained, exceptional spy could manage. Thus, the earrings are employed in an unfeminine way. But ultimately, the message they send is about their relationship, both their relationship as enemy spies and their relationship as mother-daughter. The truth it points to, however, remains just as confused by the end of the series. The truth, it turns out, is unattainable no matter how long you wait. It holds the place marker of the impossible in the mother-daughter relationship, which stems from the original deadlocks of identity. In reaction to this emotional situation, her coworker Dixon tells her, "No one can be blamed for trusting her own mother." The underside of this statement might be that no one can be blamed for her own mother's desire, or that no one can be blamed for the fact that even her own mother has an unconscious. The truth doesn't just take time and Alias, it is time, an endless loop that the roles and definitions of femaleness continually threaten to burst out of. The importance of Alias is not just that it presents a more humane way of procuring truth and dealing with terrorism. Its significance also stems from its emphasis on masquerade as the key to truth. If we see masquerade as essential to truth rather than as a barrier to it, we change from a masculinist logic to a feminist one, and we overturn the bare life philosophy that threatens to overrun every competing system of values. In the choice of Alias versus 24, our very survival is indeed at stake. Thank you.
Anybody have a question? I just wanted to know, because I have not seen a single episode of 24, but is there a situation, any situation, in which Bauer has just tortured someone and then he finds out he's wrong?
I mean, in general, the information that he gets through torturing is right. So, I mean, there are many, like in any spy thriller narrative, there are many misleads, places that they go. It's a good question, but I think in general, though, the information he gets through torture is correct. I mean, there's many times in which they go off on something and it turns out not to help, and they're, you know what I mean? But I don't remember many scenes of torture in which they get absolutely wrong information. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, the basic idea is that not only there are no legal ramifications if he doesn't go to jail for torture, but considering he's right every time, he just...
That's right. The show suggests Jack is right, I think. But it constantly threatens him with punishment. Like, his bosses are always saying, "No, you've gone too far, Jack. You're gonna have to suffer. You understand you're going out on your own this time." You know, and he says, I understand, you know. But it's sort of like the show relies on someone stepping outside of the law to help the law be upheld.
I think that's taking the hero idea to the absolute extreme, you know, going all the way against every aspect of society, every aspect of, you know, your boss telling you, you cannot do this. And Jack says, screw that, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to be right, and you're going to be wrong, and I'm going to be the macho man every single day.
And in some ways that goes along with, you know, traditional genres like the Western. I think immediately of the Western, right, where the hero comes from outside the law, comes in, fixes what's going on, and then leaves again. And in fact, Jack does that. And in many seasons, at the end of the season, he vows, he sort of just leaves, and he... And then he gets refound at the beginning of the next season.
What would you say about Alias using, I mean, to actually uncover the information, she does have to choke him.
Yeah.
So what would you say about that? Because her masquerade doesn't uncover any information in the scene that you showed.
It's yeah.
That she has to switch roles and start, she tortures him too.
Right. So my point about that is that the emphasis of the scene is not on that moment, right? It's kind of a quick, almost an accession to the genre, and it's over, right? Whereas with 24, it the whole show builds up to and lingers, you know, over the torture. And there are plenty of scenes, actually, in Alias in which she doesn't use any violence. But there are plenty of scenes in which she does. So, I mean, in that way, it is ensconced in the kind of spy thriller. You know, she's truly an action heroine here. It's not like she's an action heroine without using violence, you know. But I think that the emphasis on violence is usually on fights, like the fight scene, you know. It's never on torture. That's kind of like that. That's a quick moment. That's not as important as, like, if her alias hadn't worked, she wouldn't have been on that plane. She wouldn't have gotten that close to it, right? So it's always the alias itself that makes them succeed or fail. But for Bauer and for 24, it's always only the torture in which which someone succeeds or fails, actually. So that's what I would say. It's a good question, though.
In both shows, violence obviously plays an important part, albeit in different ways. Why do you think in Alias, though, when so much emphasis is given to femininity as being crucial for the masquerade, Sydney herself always stands alone as kind of the only woman in the show and is pitted against people who were formerly her friends at one point, and you have that traditional catfight that occurs between all of Sydney and her supposed female allies. Why do you think they resort to that level of violence in that instance?
So I'm not sure I totally understand your question. It sounds very interesting, but I'm not sure I totally got it. So do you mean why? I mean,
femininity is given such importance with Sydney as a positive, a way to get the truth.
Yeah.
Yet it's not universal. It's her femininity, and she's in fact pitted against the other female characters in the show, basically throughout the series. Even her best friend is killed and replaced with some spy.
With a person whose face has been changed to look like her friend.
Yeah, so, and that's a big, and they always have
those
cat fights.
It was so sad, wasn't it? That was a sad moment. Yes, okay, I see what you're saying. Well, actually, I think, I mean, there's gobs of stuff you can talk about in terms of Alias and the female characters, right? So if what you're saying is, so let me try and think about your question. So you're saying that if femininity is so important to Sydney, right, why doesn't it maybe infuse and create, for example, more collective amongst the women or something in those terms, mm-hmm. right? And I would say sometimes it verges on that, right? Every once in a while, her sister comes along, she's working with her sister, and there are these moments. But inevitably, always, right, it turns out she loses her sister or this person turns into someone else or it turns out the mother's bad or, you know, and she always ends up alone. I guess I would say that on a particular level, that emphasis on femininity doesn't change the sort of lone hero nature of the show, right? On the other hand, all the women on the show, I think, are pretty interesting. So, for example, her mother, who I could write on and on and on about her and her mother, right? Her mother is essentially a spy, right, is a spy from Russia who takes on an alias. But what she does wrong, essentially what the show is saying, is she takes on the alias too completely, right? Russia does wrong in terms of their female agents, in a sense, is ask them to change their identity too completely, like to take up this alias as if it's for years, you know, for like 25 years, she's supposed to take up this one alias, which is as Sydney Bristow's mother. I mean, she has this child during her alias. And so, like, the conflict for Sydney is, did she ever really love me? You know, and then her mother saying, of course I loved you, but I was also a spy. I was working, you know. So there's all these kind of, like, there's all this stuff going on that ends up resonating, you know, questions about authenticity in terms of motherhood and daughters and all these issues about what does it mean to have a working mother, you know, like, even if she's working for the other side. And but what I found interesting is that the way that Irina fails because she takes on the alias too completely, you know? So the lesson is sort of that kind of femininity can't be just fully taken on. It can only be seen as important in this kind of performance element, I would say. So I think, like, even though the women end up getting pitted against each other, many of the women characters are very interesting, you know? Interesting on the level of the ramifications about different versions of femininity, I guess I'd say.
Do you think that undermines the importance of femininity in the masquerade, though, in that the male characters on the show remain, for the most part, trustworthy, but the female characters, they're always hiding something, they're always working against one another?
Well, I wouldn't say the male characters are always trustworthy, actually. They're just as much as the female characters, they, you know, always, they end up turning against, everyone turns against Sydney in the end. And so in that way, like, except for her father, really, but she's always unsure about him because he came into her life later in life. But even her boyfriend there, she ends up disappearing for 2 years. He marries somebody else. She comes back. He's betrayed her, you know. So there's this whole sort of way in which every character who you're really sure of in the show ends up turning against her in some way. And so she ends up being this ethical center of the show. And that's, you know, in that way she's not allowed. The one thing that I sort of think lacks in complexity about Sydney is that she's not allowed to be unethical in any way. You know what I mean? I mean, she always has to be really ethical. But I think because of all the investigations that the show is doing on the level of the feminine and femininity, it just can't slide into that side also. Like, it would just fall apart, you know, if it also tried to investigate the unethical, you know, if the woman was unethical. So she remains really this hardcore ethical figure, I'd say.
I had a question about Alias. So you talked about the whole masquerade and how she puts it on, but it seems to me, like, for example, in this specific case, she's taking stuff off.
Yeah, that's true.
So, a masquerade, like, she uses her body to get information. You can't put on breasts, you can't put on a thinner body. That is what she is. That is her character. And so, and you also mentioned Buffy and Cena. These are all beautiful women with great bodies.
Right, right.
So what does that say about the stereotype of a tough woman. She's still very feminized.
Definitely. I mean, action heroines today, even from the beginning, like if I think about the book that I wrote, The Violent Woman, and even the majority of those women, except for a few interesting, more independent films, the only way they can conceive of a violent woman is if she's also a beautiful, glamorous woman. So I would absolutely hear your critique on that. Absolutely. That why is it that our action heroes can often not adhere to standards of male beauty even, right, but still have a great deal of clout and power and so forth, but that our action heroines always have to be, you know, glamorous and gorgeous. So the way that television, you know, and television, highly consumer-based, right? So the way that television deals with it oftentimes, and I was watching, I'm recently caught up in this series called Fringe. Is anybody watching it? It's like every time I'm not sure if I like it or not, but I keep watching it and sort of fascinated by it. And it's a kind of similar, so I think what the way, the concession that they have, mm-hmm. right? They choose these beautiful, you know, gorgeous, adhere to ideal beauty standards, but they almost always, in this scene she has makeup on, but in general, Jennifer Garner throughout this series has very little makeup on. I mean, you know, like, and so they strip them of that, like, and in Fringe, no makeup most of the time, hair just flat, you know. So in other words, like that's their one concession, you know, that's their one way of saying, you know, this girl's a little tougher and doesn't adhere to, you know, these other kind of senses of femininity.
Comfortable clothes.
Because she wears plain comfortable clothes, but, you know. And I haven't watched shows like CSI and these other shows, but I think it's pretty similar there, right? Kind of like plain comfortable clothes, plain hair, little makeup, and that somehow equals not feminizing too far in order to maybe, you know, suggest we're not glamorizing her in this feminine way. I mean, Alias makes this big, you know, when she is at home or at work, she is wearing very plain clothes. Like it's almost like browns, grays. You know, she's the only exciting clothes she wears is sometimes like a blue or something when she goes running. I mean, that's about it. And then, so then it really contrasts, right, mm-hmm. with her aliases. But you're absolutely right. They choose women who are, their bodies and everything are. The only difference might be that the action heroine, the actresses, during these, you know, seasons, Jennifer Garner gets pretty buff. I mean, she bulks up. And that is different than, let's say, a Gwyneth Paltrow or even a Julia Roberts kind of look, right? Mm-hmm. And people actually, there are comments, like newspaper, you know, in articles and so forth, people actually comment on her body in that way. Like even just recently, when I was looking up some clips and things to put on this, there was some news, some like, you know, tabloid-ish kind of photo of her that said, you know, Garner really, really buffed up. Is it too much? You know, like this kind of thing. So that's the only way that, you know, so the actresses themselves, in having to do all these fight scenes, I think have to bulk up a little. And that sometimes contradicts, you know, that ideal sense of beauty.
To sum all that up with these observations that you guys were just talking about, is that what you think is the success of the show? Is that what you think has grown such a big audience and, you know, members of the community for this show, is that they've been able to do both things, exercise both masculinity and femininity, perhaps?
That's a good question. Yes, I think that, and see, the thing is, though, that these shows that I'm interested in aren't always the most popular shows. Like, Alias is not as popular as 24, otherwise they might have kept going with it. I mean, I think they chose to end Alias. Unlike another show that I'm very interested in, Veronica Mars, which they canceled. So, but yes, I think that having the heroine at the center and the kind of narratives that they begin to write around her creates a different kind of structure in which different values come to the fore than in shows like 24 or other more masculine-centered shows. But then also that they kind of hold the two characteristics within the one heroine. I think you're right. So that kind of way in which they're playing with both the masculine and the feminine. And it's in constant discussion, like in every episode, you know, that's what they're struggling with. And I wouldn't say that there's, you know, I wouldn't say they've reached the ultimate progressive, blah, blah, blah. You know, no, I'd say like what's interesting about the show is that it's a show on television that's struggling with all these things in ways that some of the other shows aren't struggling with it. I guess that's what I'd say.
I'm just interested in what you were saying at the end about Alias, about truth taking time or truth being time, mm-hmm. and how you see that message sort of being communicated between mother and daughter compared to the sort of the you know, Sloan, the bad guy, like his search for immortality throughout.
That's a great question. I mean, maybe I'd say that in the end the show comes down on the side that though truth may be time, we don't have all the time in the world, right? That there's this kind of finality, obviously. And I mean, I think like what happens between the mother-daughter relationship, I think, is that Sydney's constantly searching for something she wants. She doesn't know what she wants, and she never gets what she really wants from her mother. And every once in a while, she gets little bits, and she thinks that's what a mother is. But then she betrays her, she feels, you know. And the audience, too, we every once in a while feel, okay, no, the mother's justified. And plus, Lena Olin is playing her, and she's fabulous. And so, you know, you're sort of like, I'm totally, maybe there's something to this mother. And then she betrays you, too. Like, she betrays you, the audience, as well. And you're like, oh, my God, she betrayed us. And so, you know, I think that there's this way in which that there is a kind of maybe cyclical, constant misunderstanding between mother-daughter that suggests that will always go on. But I'm not sure. That's a good question. I don't have I don't have like a direct way of answering that. But I think you're right. And maybe it's staging two different ways of engaging time, like some masculine way of engaging time versus a feminine way of engaging time. But I haven't thought through that. It's a good question.
Since you brought up Veronica Mars, which was one of my favorite shows, I was just wondering, I mean, she did a lot of the masquerading as well and
yes,
a lot
she does.
Of the different things, but she never had the violence or the torture
true.
Or anything. Do you think that's maybe a reason why it was canceled? It wasn't popular enough? I mean, Alias did a lot of the same things, but a little more violently.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's a different genre, right? Because Veronica Mars is a detective genre, right? Versus a spy thriller genre. So Veronica Mars attempts to be within the tradition of the detective genre. And in that tradition, sometimes the male detective can be violent, but a lot of times he or she doesn't have to be. And so Veronica Mars, for those of you who don't know, is about a high school student whose father is a private detective and sometimes the sheriff of the town, and she also is doing work with his agency. So she works for him, and she's very good at it. She's different than Sydney because she's not so ethical all the time, which I like about her. I mean, there's an ethical core to her, and she kind of gets more ethical as the third season happens, I think. But she's also, she can be vengeful. You know, she can be, you know, which I guess they allow her because she's a teenager in some ways. But she can be vengeful. She can be, you know, mean-spirited at times. And what I find very interesting about that show is that for the majority of the seasons, especially the first two seasons, she's a female detective investigating her own rape. And so I find it a fascinating way of undermining and creating new currents, I guess, within the structure of this genre, you know, within the detective. And it has all these ramifications, I think, for ways that those stories get told and stuff. So, yeah, I think it's a very interesting show, actually.
If Veronica Mars or this character that Jennifer Garner plays were more caustic or we didn't like them as much,
yeah.
Sort of like House or maybe Jack Bauer,
yeah, yeah.
What would the effect be, and do you think they'd be as popular? Can we take a woman who is sort of not likable?
I think we can't, and maybe that is why that Veronica Mars gets canceled. I mean, I thought about that in writing, and I wrote that I think that the show couldn't handle that. I mean, that's why Sydney has to be so nice and so ethical, you know. That doesn't mean that those female characters haven't been on television before. I guess the question is, where are they? You know, like, in what genres do they get to live, those caustic females, right? They're usually not in the spy thriller at the center of the narrative. So, and you're right, the male counterpart gets to be more caustic, right? Because the woman action heroine gets to have many, pithy lines. She gets to do that anyway. But she doesn't get to be unethical. She doesn't get to be vengeful. She doesn't get to be, because I think that it's already enough for audiences what they're doing. I think it would sort of tip it over the end and it would sort of fall apart. And maybe that is what happened to Veronica Mars. They tried to remake Veronica Mars and pitch it as she grows up. She leaves high school and she goes to college, of course, her third year. And it's interesting because she comes across all these feminist groups in college, and she ends up having. She neither gets along with the feminist groups, nor does she get along with the sorority sisters or other women on campus. So she's always alone, you know, on the campus in a sense. And then they pitched the idea of having her just leaping in time and having her become an FBI agent, like she's graduated and she goes on. But it didn't save them. Like, they ended up getting canceled anyway. So
I think we're going to have to wrap up now. I'd like to thank you all for your participation and to thank Professor Aroney for a wonderful lecture.
Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture by University of Vermont Associate Professor Hilary Neroni titled Terror, Torture, and Feminine Masquerade, The Case of Alias versus 24. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University Women's Studies Program and the Humanities Foundation. Professor Neroni was introduced by Professor Barbara Gottfried from the Women's Studies Program. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Tota and Michael Garth with help from Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.